To a certain degree, I've always incorporated a bit of the artistic side. Once you begin to see your mindset, you can then start to choose your mindset. That intrigued me. A psychology at work right there.
What if you could completely transform the way you lead and communicate by just asking better questions? Today, we're going to dive into that idea with Sean Grace, an expert in leadership, communication, and creative collaboration. This is Venture Visionaries, the podcast where we explore the strategies behind innovative leaders who are shaping the future of business. As always, I'm Thomas Agimet. And in this episode, we're speaking with Sean, who has over 25 years of experience developing sales, marketing, and leadership talent across industries. Now, Sean is not only a communication consultant and business coach, he's also an award-winning musician with a background from Juilliard. His company, Peak Luma, leverages his unique blend of business consulting and creative arts to help organizations thrive through better communication and collaboration. And he is also the author of the new book, The Art of the Question. Today, we'll explore his journey from music to business, the art of asking the right questions, and strategies for navigating interviews, networking, and even difficult conversations. If you're ready to elevate your own leadership, let's jump right in. So glad to be here with you today. First off, congratulations on your book, The Art of the Question, A Guide for Seekers, Dreamers, Problem Solvers, and Leaders. I just finished the book. When I read the title of the book, I was like, those are a whole lot of people to try and address in one book. The density of what you pack into this is pretty incredible. I think that's a pretty wide survey of potential identities to be talking to. A lot of people kind of pick a specific persona and run after them. Why did you choose to go so wide?
Well, first of all, thanks so much for having me on the program, Thomas, and appreciate you kind of kicking us off with the book, The Art of the Question. And yes, it is a guide for seekers, dreamers, problem solvers, and leaders. And it is a very wide scope of people and disciplines. But in my development of the concepts over many years, just continued to expand its application. There was a common thread between great leaders and good problem solvers and seekers and dreamers. I mean, the leadership is a primary aspect of the book. The elements and characteristics of good leadership, I think, contain the artist, contain the dreamer, contain the seeker, and contain the efficient strategic problem solver. As I thought these concepts through, as they apply to creative thinking and innovation and communications all around the idea of questions, I said, well, wouldn't it be interesting if I could figure out a way to bring all these together and have a common thread that addresses, now granted, one could write a book on each one of those, certainly write an entire book on the creative process as it relates to how we approach using questions. But for the sake of this tome that I decided to tackle, maybe a little ambitious, but in the end, I felt I was successful in tying the bow and creating. And I do mention that in the beginning that I say the book is for dreamers and seekers, and this is why and this is how. And then I end it in a similar way, saying that I hope that none of these are mutually exclusive, that for all of us who seek, you know, who are curious and who seek higher consciousness and who seek deeper relationships and better connections and all of those things, I think the question is a central part of all of that aspect. So I was trying to bring all that together. Yeah.
You are a musician, Juilliard trained. You're very much a business person, Wharton trained. You are a coach. You're still actively a producer. I see some parallels between how you've chosen not to choose in terms of how you spend your time and how you think of these things as interplayed. And you kind of alluded to this. I think as you read the book, it's very clear that we're not just talking to one part of you, but listening to the conversation that all these different parts of you are constantly having with each other. What do you think is the musician talking in this book?
What part do you think is the business person talking? What part do you think is the coach talking? And are there any other layers at the table that I haven't mentioned that you think are finding their voice in your tone?
The musician and the artist aspect of me certainly speaks to much of the third part of the book, which is the concept of improvisation, creative collaboration, creative thinking, and problem solving from a design standpoint. That all kind of comes from my creative background and a lot of my experience as a musician, as a performing musician, as a composing musician, as well as a producing musician. However, I have a lot of background in the arena of management and leadership, as well as marketing and other aspects of the business world in that respect. Yeah. I guess to a certain degree, I've always incorporated a bit of the artistic side, but there's no doubt about it. There was a divide. I never have been able to completely merge them all together in some perfect Uber entity, you know. However, as I start the book with the first chapter called Curiosity, I think it speaks to this never-ending sense of curiosity that I've had ever since I was a kid. And I even indicate in the chapter that sometimes its drive hasn't always served me well. I do tend to want to learn about things, and I could, you know, spend a lot of time maybe delving into areas that might be better spent honing in other arenas. So I guess there's a little bit of a restlessness in me. But that also has given me a very wide palette of experience. Thankfully, I feel I've been able to analogically bring one to the other, share ideas across all of these disciplines and experiences. I think as a result, bring a unique perspective to others, especially in the arena of consulting, training, managing, and leadership development, where I think I can pull from a lot of these areas and bring something a little more fresh, as opposed to being solely within the business arena for my entire career, or solely in the arts.
I wonder if you could shape for our readers, where is Sean from, and who are some of the earliest influences that you think are most represented in the Sean we read in this book?
I was born and raised on Long Island, New York, first generation Irish. My parents came here before I was born with four of my older siblings in tow, and then had four more. And I was the last of the clan. So I'm the youngest of eight, an Irish Catholic family, immigrants. My dad was an engineer, architect by training, although that was hard to get work here as an Irish immigrant at the time, at least as an architect. So he ended up doing more engineering work. So I was surrounded by older siblings who all had their own special talents and abilities, and I absorbed a lot of their experiences and paid a lot of attention, and I'm sure annoyed the hell out of them, asking them lots of questions about the world. So they each, you know, in their own way, gave me a certain perspective on the world around me. And at a very young age, I then became interested in music. Age I was eight, you know, I was sort of into music. And by the time I was 11, I was performing at Carnegie Hall, but just as a young artist, because I had won a young artist competition. So there were a few of us who performed a short afternoon performance there, but it was very exciting.
Yeah,
and then I ended up at the Juilliard School of Music when I was 12 as a pre-college student. That was also very exciting because I was exposed to an international student body of young virtuosos. That gave me a whole world of perspective on possibility within arts and discipline and excellence at levels that I hadn't seen before, which I think raised the bar for me to a large degree. Moved on and went to school as a music performance major, kind of an English minor, and then left and then also pursued additional business training at places like Wharton in order to hone my skills in the world of business. But I started out very much as a musician. I figured that would be my path. When I was in high school, I had already been performing on big stages and recording and things. I soon realized how difficult it was to make a good living as a musician. I quickly adapted and learned some things in marketing and publishing. And before you know it, I was on that track. So those two tracks kind of existed for a while. All kinds of experiences in the business world unfolded from there, as well as my musical world. I produced many albums for myself, did several tours. So I was able to keep them both. But certainly the business world was my primary mode of operating most of the time.
it's very clear to see how, one, this picture of your home being such a place that was full in so many ways of ideas and people, and how often that is such a beautiful breeding ground for, I think, the kind of curiosity that you develop. But you also share something really vulnerable in your book that I was really struck by early on when you mention a child therapist being one of your first examples of asking really powerful questions and being introduced there, actually kind of navigating a rebellious period of teenagehood, which I think many of our listeners can probably relate to. I know I certainly can. We love the "I'm curious because I was performing in Carnegie Hall at 12 type of story. The reality is, for many of us, we're also curious because of some of the harder stuff. And I'm curious how the harder stuff plays into all of this. And in particular, if we shift gears as a coach, I imagine the experience both with kind of some of the highs, but also with some of the challenge are really useful to your practice. If you could speak to kind of how those come together for you.
Great insight there. Thank you very much for that. I do talk about my first encounter with what I consider great questioning. And it was a therapist that my folks sent me to when I was a teenager. And it was a difficult period, probably more so for them than for me, because I was just, you know, I was just being very rebellious. I was in a rock band and was home, but I, you know, there'd be times where I would maybe disappear for the weekend, do a bunch of gigs, and maybe miss school on Monday. And grades were certainly getting affected. And this, I think, was alarming, certainly, for those who cared a lot about me and saw that, oh my God, you know, maybe he's really on the wrong track here. And maybe I certainly was. I don't deny that I wasn't. However, you know, they suggested that I speak with this person, and she was able to kind of reframe a lot of my thinking and about how I saw the world and how I saw myself and address some of the difficulties that I felt I was facing and some of the turmoil that was going on inside me as a 15 or 16 year old. You know, there was definitely a good, you know, year plus, maybe year and a half or two there that was kind of rough. And that experience, I think, also shaped me in being able to empathize with others who I've encountered who have been in similar situations. I can kind of call back to that time. And certainly that's was a formative experience, I think, for me. And it showed that it wasn't smooth sailing. They were turbulent, rough waters that had to be addressed at a young age, and I had to grow up fast. Those realizations matured me a lot. By the time I got to college, I felt I had a certain level of maturity that maybe my other classmates and such, maybe when I looked at them, maybe I'd think that they didn't, whether they did or they didn't. But certainly at the time, I felt a little more sure about myself and a little more confident about things. I think you might be right that that may certainly have shaped me, but certainly it pointed to the power of great questioning. Those questions that forced me to be able to look at myself more carefully. That intrigued me. Psychology at work right there.
Yeah. I wonder if you could kind of share with us just a little bit more on your philosophy of the types of questions we ask ourselves, maybe the ones that we avoid asking ourselves that we should be asking, or maybe the questions that we're asking that are the wrong ones.
It does begin after curiosity, and I do then spend a chapter on sort of the great philosophers and how they came up with some of the frameworks. But certainly, when it comes to the reader, it's very much, it has to start with yourself. That process, it's not just self-awareness. It's sort of a metacognitive process, includes self-awareness, emotional intelligence, and what I call sort of the observing self. The chapter starts off with the quote, "Once you begin to see your mindset, you can then start to choose your mindset." Based on the premise that within each of us, there is a thinking self, a feeling self, and a noticing self or observing self. They all three exist, but the two that take pretty much all the attention is the thinking self, which often overthinks and gets us caught in ruminations about the past and fantasies about the future. And our feeling self is pushing and pulling us in various emotional directions, not always productively. Then there's this observing self, which exists that we often don't tap into, that simply observes what's going on with us. If there's a way to elevate that observing self, you'll be in a better position to create some distance between the thoughts and the feelings that often entangle us and disable us in being able to make good decisions, being able to react appropriately in situations, maybe in ways that are not so productive for a relationship or for communication in general. That observing self comes along with asking questions about what I'm thinking, what I'm feeling, where is that coming from? Is this based on some past experience? Is this feeling coming from some type of belief? Is that belief helping me or hurting me? You can ask a whole bunch of questions regarding, you know, what's going on with me, maybe emotionally. Other aspects of questioning would be in the arena of problem solving, where you can actually separate yourself from your problem solving process and then analyze, have I seen this before? Is this the best approach to this particular problem? Mm. Are we even asking the right question? Mm. Right. So these are kind of meta questions that direct back to ourselves, which elevate that objective part of ourselves, which separates again from that the biases that exist within us emotionally, as well as those thought strings, which can really drive us mad. I do believe that great leadership and effective communication starts with asking better questions of oneself, then improves our overall ability to function and navigate and communicate.
Do you have a story of a time where you found tapping into your noticing self significantly kind of changed how you chose to engage with a situation?
Well, sure. I mean, it happens certainly all the time where my first reaction to something, I get a feeling that, you know, maybe a fine feeling, but may not be a fine feeling, or maybe the reaction may not be a great reaction for the circumstance, but I feel it welling up. And the more I notice its sort of position within me, I'm able to stop. And once I stop, my observing self raises up. It then looks back down at me and says, okay, what's the best way to respond to this situation right now, all things considered? Mm-hmm. What's more important in this conversation, proving a point or learning something? These are the things that the observing self would ask me. Then I'll be able to proceed without reacting in a way that I might regret. I think they go hand in hand, the observing self, with that, the objective aspect of waiting, pausing, and not jumping to a conclusion about what you're witnessing. When you hold back judgment, all of a sudden the observing self gets elevated and you're able to have a broader perspective on what might be a better response or reaction to what might be happening around you.
I'd love to run through like a couple of scenarios that are pretty germane and pick through some tidbits on what the right questions might be and what lenses we can take to move through with those. So I think one of the ones I'd love to start with, just given our talent market right now, which has been extremely weird, to use a scientific term, there's quite a bit of uncertainty around exactly what's happening in our talent market. Some of that is driven by just this rapid increase in the use of AI, both from candidates submitting resumes, as well as what is doing resume sorting. And I think we're also in a lot of uncertainty with the market still. But particularly in the world of especially tech and like high tech, still a lot of uncertainty. All of that is meant is there's a lot of like wait and see, a lot of uncertainty in the process. And I think that interviews in particular are becoming these much more higher stakes experiences for people. How might thinking about the right questions provide insight to this process?
Questions, I think, play such a critical role in the world of job interviewing because they not only allow you to gather more information for your own edification, understanding about the job and the fit, but the way you ask your question is going to also impress upon or not the person that is interviewing you, and your questioning skills will point to your critical thinking ability. Your strategic thinking skills is all based on the types of questions you might ask. So these are all opportunities to be able to not only get information about the job, but also influence how the other person perceives you. And then maybe even more importantly, how the interview unfolds. I often recommend that you try to weave questions within the interview itself. Now, some interviewers insist to hold off your questions until the end, and that's okay too. You can work with that. Ideally, it's better to weave your questions in a conversational way. So it is a conversation and it's not an interrogation on either side. So you want to create a conversation during the interview and you want to be able to answer any question that is posed to you. But you also might want to consider following up your answers with questions. If the interviewer says, give me an example of how you might have handled a situation in the past with these circumstances and these pressures and these constraints, and then you bring up a case study where, you know, you and your team was developing team or whatever the case might be, whatever your objective was, and you came across a problem and you overcame it by doing X, Y, and Z. Now, you could leave it there and then have them ask you another question, say, oh, yeah, that's pretty cool. Let me ask this. Or you can just follow up with, how do your teams typically handle situations like that? Can you give me an example of how your team managed a situation like that? It has to be organic. None of this can be stilted or unnatural. It has to be conversational. But the point is that you then follow up with a question that is relevant to the answer that you gave, but then creates an opportunity to explore more about how the team that you might be joining works in situations, how the leader or the managing person manages the team. There's endless questions you can come up with that will, number one, give you more information about the job, the opportunity, the future, the fit, in addition to helping them see you as a smart, critical thinker, but also your ability to navigate the conversation in a way and direct it in a way that's going to actually bring out your greatest strengths. So if you're sensitive to the questions and then you're able to pivot, you're able to then, all of a sudden, before you know, you're in charge of the interview. You're driving the interview. Now, they don't know it, but that's okay because it's all natural and it's flowing like a regular conversation. But now you're no longer in the backseat. You're in the front seat, and maybe you're driving together.
I wonder if you could speak a little bit to kind of the first interaction questions that allow you to maybe glean some of the benefit that you're talking about in these interviews, go beneath the surface, but are appropriate for an informal setting.
Well, yeah, I mean, networking, boy, that's a conundrum for a lot of us, right? It's an awkward scenario. You don't often know people. You're at a conference and, you know, you want to meet people, but you're not sure how to do it, right? A line that I typically like to use, especially if it's a conference, trade show or whatever, I'll typically walk up to somebody or a group of people at one of those high top tables where they're having their little noshes in their drink. And I come up with my noshes in my drink because I'm looking for a place to put my stuff, right? So I might put my plate down and say, hello, gentlemen, how's it going? Or whoever it might be. And I might say, hey, what'd you think of the keynote this morning? Anybody attend that? So I will approach from a standpoint, I want to ask a question and I'm going to ask it that it's likely somebody there. I'm assuming, say, it's a group. If it's just one person, I might ask the same thing. There's a good chance that they will have something to say. Now, these are ways to break ice, but they're also ways to, after you've broken the ice, to continue the conversation. If you approach it, you know, you're not alone here, and many people would be happy if somebody came up to them and had a short conversation, because they may not be willing to open up the conversation. So first, you have to approach it like a human being. It's not about business. It's just about connecting. If you could just simply connect human to human to start, and then, you know, you could spark that with a question about the conference. But I wouldn't say, hey, how's business? I would create a bridge, because those kind of questions are a little more personal, a little more, let's get to know each other for 30 seconds, you know? So I try to create questions that are safe, that have common ground, and that somebody could actually opinionate about. And that typically opens up a myriad of possibilities from where to go from there.
One other scenario I'd love to walk you through is there's a whole kind of section on difficult conversations. How do you define difficult conversations?
Well, how do you define a difficult conversation? I think a difficult conversation is one where the stakes are rather high. I think there's a book out called Crucial Conversations, and they talk about that idea of the stakes being quite high. I believe they use that term. So I think that that's true, whether that's in a job interview or whether that's a difficult conversation with a loved one, or whether it's to an employee who's having issues, where it might be difficult to have the conversation because you know there's going to be some discomfort in the conversation. But my rule with communication in general, but certainly with difficult conversations, is to cleave the person from the problem. If in fact it's a problem that you're addressing, and difficult conversations often revolve around problems. So if you start with separate the person from the problem, you can create some distance in order for both of you to examine the situation without having the problem wrapped around the person as a person. The problem I find with a lot of communication, especially when it comes to these types of, I need to give feedback, but it's not going to be received well, or behavior's not great, so I really need to address it, is that they approach it as if the behavior is the person. And they don't pay enough attention, I think, to the idea that behavior is behavior and the person's the person. And whether it's something that they tend to do all the time, it's still a behavior that's outside of themselves, in a sense that, and I think if you approach it this way, they're more likely to try to do something about it because it creates a little distance, right? So the communication wheel is an example, what I use in the book to demonstrate a visual framework for walking through a difficult conversation. It starts with talk about what you observed. The next one would be, here's how I interpreted what I observed, right? So the problem's in the center. You're talking to the person. Here's a behavior of something I observed. Here's how I interpreted that observation. And thirdly, this is how that made me feel. You're talking about a behavior, a thing that happened, and you're doing it from an objective standpoint. We were in this meeting the other day, and I noticed that you had interrupted Susan when she was in the middle of her discussion about her idea. Let me tell you how I interpreted that. I interpreted it as if maybe you weren't paying attention to Sue's idea, but I don't know. And this is how it made me feel. It made me feel a little uncomfortable because as a leader of the team, I want to make sure everyone has their own voice, and that we all have an opportunity to share our thoughts. So now you're still keeping it separate, right? You're not dragging them totally into it. And then you move through the wheel where you sort of bargain. You say, listen, this is what I hope for, and this is what I want.
Yeah.
This is what I'm willing to do. But of course, it should be a conversation because the person might say, well, wait a minute, that's not how I interpreted it. How did you perceive that encounter in the meeting? You know, Susan, she always talks and she dominates the meeting, and I felt it was important for me to speak my mind. Okay, behavior's over there. You're responding to the behavior. You're keeping it away from the individual themselves. In the end, hopefully there's a compromise. I understand where you're coming from. This is what I'm willing to do. I'm willing to meet with Susan, and I'm willing to talk about some of your concerns. Maybe the three of us can get together and work this out. Here's what I'm hoping to get from you. The want. And that could be during our meetings, you know, we each have our turn, whatever the protocol is. The communication wheel is a handy tool in helping us visualize the five or six steps one can go through in dealing with a potentially contentious conversation, with the primary core principle that you cleave the person from the problem, which gives them more agency to do something about it. And they don't feel personally impugned by accusation.
Exactly. And what a beautiful preview. For more details on that, get Sean's book, The Art of the Question. But, you know, the world of business can tend to be, especially as organizations grow in size, a very structured place. And some of that structure and bureaucracy and red tape feels like it gets in the way of improvisation. What is the value of improvisation in an organization? Why should leaders even care?
Yeah, I do spend the last third of the book talking about innovation, creative thinking, creative collaboration, and improvisation is a key aspect of all of that. What's beautiful about improvisation is this idea of positive collaboration in order to build together. If you ever studied improv theater, there is a basic concept called yes and. The concept is really built around the idea that if I create a scene, you're not there to shoot it down as a partner. You're there to build upon it. The idea is yes, and then you can build from there, as opposed to saying, no, that's not quite right. No, that's not quite right. The secondary concept against that would be the devil's advocate. Now, we all need, I think, at times a devil's advocate. But the problem in business is that you've got a lot of smart people within the ranks who need to prove themselves on a regular basis by showing how all the ways an idea won't work. What's beautiful about improvisation maybe Miles Davis or somebody had said something along the lines that somebody asked him, hey, what do you do when you hit a wrong note? He said, well, it's not a wrong note, depending on what the band does right afterwards. And I thought about that. Now, I played a fair amount of jazz and I've played my fair share of bad notes, right? And but the greatest musicians I've worked with, within a millisecond, took that bad note, created a new harmonic structure that brought the tune into a whole different direction. And the ones who are not as accomplished that I've worked with, they stick with the script. I think what's happened with American companies and from a standpoint of culture is that you've moved away from the industrial sort of, okay, here's the way it needs to be done. We need a workforce who's going to follow rules and who can execute these rules in a very predictable way. Command and control from the management standpoint and following orders on the front line. That made sense when we're producing all kinds of goods from an assembly line kind of aspect. But in the past 20 or 30 years, what's happened is that innovation has taken over and tech has taken over from the standpoint of, okay, it's no longer about these things. It's about ideas. Mm-hmm. And what we need are creative thinkers and thinkers who are able to think beyond what the script is. We all need a good, solid foundation. We all need a solid script to a certain degree. But I think what's happened in the last 20 years in corporate America is there's more of a realization that you need more flexibility in the ability of teams to be able to make decisions on their own quickly, to be able to pivot in a way that is more attached to the customer, as opposed to in the past where the customer was defined very carefully and they spent years developing an idea that they were going to pursue for the next 30 or 40 years. That's no longer the case. You come up with a piece of software, it may be obsolete in a few months. You need to constantly innovate and constantly iterate. That requires some improvisation. That requires teams to be constantly looking to build on each other's ideas to be able to maybe find an anomaly and look at its possibility and say, hey, what can we do with this? As well as managing others from an improvisational standpoint, where it's about giving a lot of flexibility within the process without taking away the foundation and the fundamentals of what you're there to do. What's happened is it's opened up this arena for creative thinking, especially in leadership in companies. And I think it's growing. So that's why I think improvisation and even taking improv classes will help leaders and teams be more nimble, be more aware, and build upon ideas as opposed to following rules strictly. And also just shooting things down and looking at the devil's advocate as being, well, that's the smart guy.
So grateful for you taking the time to talk with us. So grateful for your book, The Art of the Question. Highly and highly recommend to all our listeners. We'll have information about it available at the end and on our website. But, you know, in closing, I'm curious, what are you excited about in the next couple of months and why?
Well, I have lots of workshops I'm doing, so I'll be busy the next few months on the road as well as virtually. Of course, continuing to promote the book, I have a couple of musical projects that I've been working on that may come out early next year. So I'm pretty busy. I love the idea of writing another book, but man, it wasn't an easy task, not to say that anything worthwhile is, but I would love to at some point start working on ideas for another book. Between all that, I think I'm going to keep myself pretty busy.
For sure. And if folks are interested in some of your workshops, what's the best way to get in touch with you?
Yeah, through the website Peakluma, PEAKLUMA.com. Peakluma is sort of metaphorical for ascending leadership and bringing out the brightest within you, which is Luma, you know, so Luma, light, enlightenment, and peak, of course, being apex and rising. So that's what Peak Luma is about, strictly focused on the leadership development work that we do here.
That's a wrap for today's episode with Sean Grace. We learned about the power of curiosity, how to approach interviews with the right questions, and the role of improvisation in business leadership. A huge thank you to Sean for sharing his insights. And don't forget to check out his book, The Art of the Question, for more on how asking better questions can improve your personal and professional life. Sean has some exciting workshops and musical projects in the pipeline, so stay tuned for more from him. Now, if you enjoyed this episode, make sure to subscribe, leave us a review, and share it with your network.
We'll be back next time with another visionary leader. So until then, keep building your vision and making an impact. Curious for more? Check out People and Possibilities by TL Partners, my brand new podcast, where rather than centering people, we center some of the big ideas in the world of HR and people that are transforming the world as we know it. We kick off the series with a deep dive into AI and HR. Definitely check it out for more.